Greetings, Race Community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Michael Bohr, a fellow entrepreneur who serves as co-founder and CEO of the Endowment Project. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Brent. Good to see you.
So this is going to be a slightly different episode than we typically have here on the Race Podcast, which is most focused on letting advancement leaders tell their stories. But at the same time, I've had the opportunity to host other entrepreneurs that are doing work either directly or adjacently to this sector. And once I learned about the Endowment Project, I was just personally really interested and I wanted to get to know Michael better. We've had a couple of calls and want to share that story with you all. And so Michael, before we dive into your entrepreneurial journey, let's learn a little bit about your education journey. So usually I start in junior year of high school, but in your case, given that you went to one of our longest friends and customers in the space, Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts, I'd like to know a little bit more about what led you to Andover. Who was that, Michael? What was he into? And yeah, let's start there.
Well, there are a couple points in my education journey where I feel like I was probably an admissions mistake. And Andover was one of those. You know, I was a day student, grew up in the town. I was kind of a long shot admit, I'm sure. So I was very, very surprised to get the acceptance letter. And it was an absolutely amazing experience. That school does a tremendous job of, you know, if you're a smart, motivated kid, getting every last bit out of you. And if you're not yet there, turning you into kind of an academic athlete, very focused on academics and goals and learning, some just for the sake of learning. Some of my best friends in the world are from Andover still. And the teachers and faculty and administration there is just absolutely top notch. So if you gave me a year to think of some negative things to say about Andover, I'm not sure I could come up with one.
I love it. One of my original co-founders at Evertrue, Jesse Bardo, taught me what the expression fact brat meant. And he grew up, and his father was an English teacher. And It was a really amazing window into a world that I knew nothing about. You know, growing up in Iowa on a farm, it was just sort of the polar opposite of that experience. And feel grateful to have learned a lot about it via Jesse and love hearing stories like yours.
Yeah, and you know, up to today, the secretary of the academy and head of development, Tom Lockerbie, is on our board. He's someone, when I came up with the idea and was writing the business plan for the Endowment Project, I just cold called him, said, "Hey, I don't know anything about advancement or alumni development, but I know you do it really, really well." And he, with nothing to gain other than to be helpful and supportive, spent a bunch of time with me. I flew up to Boston. I spent some time with him there. And just at every step, and he's traveling around the world. Whenever I reach out to him, he's in China or Dubai. He's just always available and he's always helpful. And then another bit of Andover is that a guy in my Andover class, who I got to know, is probably the smartest guy in our class, Alan Sung, is now on our foundations board. So kind of have Andover tentacles all in and around the organization we're building, and it's fantastic.
Well, it's amazing, and I think as people learn more about what the Endowment Project is, why you're doing it, to try to, you know, bring some of that DNA and track record and perspective and inject that into public schools all over the country, it's a big idea. It's a big mission. And I look forward to diving into that. But first, let's learn a little bit more just about your own career journey. You went to Lehigh, you studied finance, you sort of started on the finance path, and then along the way discovered on purpose or accidentally entrepreneurship. So just take me through that kind of early part of your career and then when you got the entrepreneurial bug.
Well, one of my best friends at Andover was a guy whose dad had a very entrepreneurial business. It was a manufacturing business. And when we were still in high school, he hired my buddy and I to work on the assembly line. And just seeing what he had built from small little manufacturing company into a public company was very inspiring to me. And so he was kind of like a mentor to me, or just the idea of him was mentoring to me as I grew through my career. So having not a lot of resources growing up or, you know, through college, I figured that the best way to make enough money to enable me to pursue my entrepreneurial dreams was to get into finance, which is what everybody told me. So that's what I did. Got into financial consulting, financial fraud investigations, then eventually got into investment banking in the tech sector, and then went to business school. And out of business school, went back into banking, really just with an idea to do it for a couple of years, build up enough resources so I'd feel more comfortable jumping into a non, you know, no earnings period so I could build something. And actually really ended up enjoying, I went to a middle market mergers and acquisitions boutique called Harris Williams, not really a boutique anymore. They've actually gotten very big, but grew with them for about 8 years. And then eventually was kind of writing mini business plans along the way. Eventually happened upon an idea that I just couldn't get out of my head. So I left in 2010.
Let me just ask a question quick, because when you were at Harris Williams, I was actually at William Blair & Company. And I feel like Harris Williams was like the hot new, you know, if we were the Channel 4 news team, they were like the hot new Channel 7 news team kind of vibe. And I feel like there might have even been, you know, situations where we were like on a plane going to a pitch and it was like, oh, there's the Harris Williams guys over there too. I have like a specific memory of that, in fact. But when I was in that role, I was an analyst. I was the most junior person on the team. But I just always remember like my favorite part was meeting the entrepreneurs, because we worked with a lot of founder-led companies. And I just, maybe similar to the way you were describing, like getting a window into the manufacturing business and seeing how it had started from nothing and grown to something meaningful. But for me, it was like meeting the founders and really realizing, oh, they're just normal people too. Like there's not some magical aura or that they've got every single thing figured out. Like, they went for it. They were, you know, commonly very persistent in their pursuit of whatever they were doing. But it actually made entrepreneurship like way more accessible to me, because it just kind of showed, like I got a first row, front row seat to just how like normal the people were that were doing it.
I could not agree with you more. And it's frankly probably what kept me there for as long as it did. You know, I thought I'd be there for a couple of years. I was there for 8 years. But like you said, meeting the entrepreneurs, the people whose companies we were selling, was the greatest part of it. And several of them have invested in my businesses along the way. I've maintained, you know, really good relationships with a lot of these folks. And it was a great time. You know, I think it's easy to poo-poo banking, but I learned so much that has helped me, you know, become better at what I do. I think mostly like sales. You know, you go through undergrad, you go through a long business career, you go to business school, and there's really not a sales class anywhere in traditional education. So unless you take like a Sandler sales training or you go find someone who can teach you, there's just not something that does that for you. And I feel like M&A does that. It helps you manage objections and learn how to market a business and draw out its positives and present them the right way that's compelling. And all of that is just super important as an entrepreneur in raising money, in hiring good people, in building your company and getting revenues, just being a good salesperson. So I credit like my time in banking with helping me on that. But yeah, no, like you said, just super inspiring to see these business professionals who started small and all of a sudden they're dealing with a Blair or a Harris Williams that is going to sell their company for several hundred million dollars. And you know, it's just inspiring.
Yeah, no, for sure. So one thing to be inspired, another thing to take the leap. And so tell me about like the initial spark, if you have a specific moment around car lots, and then the initial leap?
So I had a notebook that I kept in my bag. As you know, we traveled a ton. We were probably on the same flight to the same pitch at some point back then. And I just had a notebook, and I would write on the top line of the page, I would write the idea. And then while I was traveling, I would try to fill out a one-page business plan. And usually by doing that, I would find that most of my ideas were really horrible. But if I could get through a page and convince myself it was worthy of my time, then it would kind of go into a separate part of the notebook. And when it was time for me to leave, there were a couple ideas, car lots being one of them, that I just couldn't help but shake. And so I left Harris Williams with the idea that there were two businesses that I would try to figure out which was the best one. And being in Richmond, Virginia, where CarMax is located and founded by another tremendous entrepreneur, Rick Sharp, I just had access to car people and everyone here. It's a small town and people take meetings, and I would meet a ton of people in Starbucks, and a lot of them were CarMax execs or CarMax alum. And I just learned a decent amount about the space. They liked my idea. They thought they had legs. I got several of them to invest. And so in 2011, we kicked off with, one location. Fast forward, we grew it to 22 locations around the country, several hundred million dollars of capital raises, including a merger with a SPAC that made us a public company in 2021. And then subsequently I left, and then it was acquired by one of its competitors. Unfortunately, it has since gone out of business, but it was an incredible journey. It was 10 years of, the entrepreneurial roller coaster, like I just never imagined. And a lot of good times, a lot of difficult times, but definitely was a tremendous, personal experience to ride the wave that long.
Amazing. I love it. And at the same time, along the way, when and how did you get exposure to this idea of bringing private school or large institution endowment capabilities to the public education market? Like, was it somewhere along the way you got roped in to help raise money for a school, or just where did that seed get planted on that journey?
Yeah, so I started the company with two co-founders, one of whom was from Detroit, and one was from Richmond, Virginia, who went to public school in Richmond, Virginia. They went to Freeman High School. And the day after we went public, which was, at the time, a tremendous, wealth creation event for all the investors and management team and everybody. It was, a day later, Andover's development team called me. And I thought that was remarkably sophisticated of them. I didn't even know they knew I had a business. It's not like we stayed in touch that well. I'd get emails from them and give a couple bucks. But it was just kind of surprising that they were so on top of it. And I was chatting with my co-founder, who went to public school, about, his relationship with Freeman High School. And he said they're really, other than he maintained contact with friends from high school, there was no relationship with the school. There's no alumni development person. He's never gotten a call. That's just not a thing. And it's just kind of stuck to me. I left car lots about a year later, a little longer than a year later. And I just couldn't shake this idea. Like, why? There are 200 million Americans that went to public high school, and really virtually none of them are developed for philanthropy or just developed in any way. So I started doing some research. And if you Google major gifts to a public high school, there's one name that comes up, and it's Steve Schwartzman, who gave $25 million to Abington High School in Pennsylvania. And through a number of networks, I had a meeting with him about his gift. And his idea was that he was going to raise a bunch of money for Abington, or donate a bunch of money to Abington High School. And he was going to be able to track the outcomes and see incredible impact at the school. And then he was going to challenge his billionaire buddies to do the same with the schools that they care about, and that it was going to turn into this movement. But it really didn't turn into that. It became a PR nightmare. There was no infrastructure to accept the gift and deploy the gift efficiently. And, you know, ultimately his dollars did great things at Abington High School, but it ultimately, you know, didn't go the way he wanted it to go. And I told him I was going to work on the idea. And he said, well, that's fine. I wouldn't if I were you. And but if you do, you know, don't come back to me unless you figure out a way to do it where you don't need to be beholden to decision making by school committees, school boards, superintendents, the bureaucracy of public education. So we continued our research and we happened upon the Boston Latin School, which is one of the oldest public high schools in the country. It's a part of the Boston Public School System. Excuse me. And about 100 years ago, it formed this Boston Latin School Association, BLSA, and which is effectively an alumni association. And about 30 years ago, they got really serious about fundraising. And in that time, they've raised a $75 million endowment, which by far, by many, many times, is larger than the next largest public school endowment. If you go to the wealthiest corners of America, you'll see maybe a $1 or $2 million endowment. But with that $75 million endowment, every year, $3 to $5 million comes off to pay for scholarships to the kids who are going off to college who need it. Half the kids at Boston Latin are on free lunches. It pays for seven or eight full-time resources at the school whose paycheck doesn't come from the Boston Public School System. It comes from the BLSA. They get technology dropped off. They have international programs. They have summer programs. They 1099 teachers to go above and beyond their contracts if they'd like to make more money and provide, you know, additional resources to kids. So it just looks and feels like a private school because it has this additional resource that enables the school to use money where they see it is most needed. And it's not, you know, related to what the school board or the superintendent or what the bureaucracy thinks the dollar should be spent on. So if you look, you know, every once in a while, there's a op-ed in the Boston Globe where people complain that, you know, Boston Latin has all this money they should share with other schools in the Boston public school system. And the head of Boston Latin School Association says, well, you know, we're a 501c3. The dollars we have here are restricted for Boston Latin. So that's where we need to spend the dollars. But the good news is anyone can do this. Nothing we're doing is proprietary. If you want a foundation or an endowment at your school, someone just needs to do it. And so essentially the endowment project is the Boston Latin School Association for everybody else.
I love it. I love it. Totally resonates. And it's, you know, I would imagine you often hear something along the lines of, I can't believe this doesn't exist. Like if you can, there's clear precedent for private high schools to raise money. There's clear precedent for public universities to raise money from donors. There's clear precedent for public universities, which 40 years ago were maybe almost fully reliant on taxpayer subsidized, you know, revenue, that have materially grown their endowments and also their ability to distribute and fund initiatives that maybe wouldn't be as fundable through the traditional taxpayer model. Why wouldn't we have this for public high schools? And so it's one of those, like, of course this should exist. And look, everybody has some exposure to the booster club, right? Like we had a booster club, you know, at my high school in Iowa. And it was like, hey, we need some footballs for the team. Let's donate. But it wasn't, let's build an endowment that can create an ongoing revenue stream in perpetuity to be able to, you know, complete XYZ an initiative. It was much more ad hoc, you know, and so there's some precedent, but not with the kind of infrastructure you're describing.
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, we've been doing this now for a year and a half, and I now know why it doesn't exist. It's really, really hard. And there are lots of things about it that are really hard. So internally, it's really hard because there's not a database of where everybody went to high school and how to reach them. So that's something that we've spent maybe $1 million or more building. You know, at Andover, where I went to high school, we have 25,000 living alumni, and the development office knows how to reach 92% of them. In a local county here that we went to, they have about 12 public high schools. If you take all those 12 high schools and you go back to the dawn of man, show me your database of alumni, they have a spreadsheet with 200 names on it. And so it just doesn't exist. So we're spending a lot of resources building that. Perhaps even more difficult, though, is despite us believing that we came up with a way to work around the bureaucracy, what we found is it is virtually impossible to do that. There are a lot of really well-meaning people in the system, and everybody, I mean, maybe not everybody, but the vast majority of people that we run into make life really difficult. They think they're doing the right thing by the kids and being good stewards of education. But they're, you know, really causing an existential threat to our success in, you know, layering bureaucracy and approvals and red tape upon red tape, and even, you know, telling us not to execute our plan in their areas because it may be competitive with a PTA or a booster or something else. And nobody raises money from alumni. That just doesn't happen. So we're just not competitive with anybody out there. But the fear of the potential competition is enough to, we've had cease and desist letters come to us from various regions in Virginia where we operate. One by one, we've, you know, met with people who make decisions, and slowly we're getting approved to work here. But, you know, the concept of doing it totally outside of the bureaucracy has proved to be impossible, because what we kind of failed to factor in is that even if we go meet with the principal, have a great meeting with him, he's excited about, he or she is getting excited about us getting started, all it takes is their boss, the superintendent or the school board, to say, whoa, 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 you're not doing this around us. We need to be involved. We need to determine how these dollars get spent. You're just a principal. And so it's just been a lot more challenging than we thought. Unfortunately so, because I think, you know, we had some very early successes, raised, you know, $500,000 for schools in Virginia. And we're actually having a very difficult time deploying those dollars because some principals have been told not to call us back. And we've got pools of dollars that are restricted for these schools. They have to get spent there or they have to be returned. And we're having a really difficult time deploying it. So we're, you know, we've got these obstacles that we're facing that we're hopefully slowly working through, but it's been a little bit disappointing to see the state of public education and how it's run and managed.
Yeah. And look, I think, right, in every market, there's an adoption curve. And so the question is, how do you find the early adopters? You know, now that you've got even more of an appreciation for some of what Steve Schwartzman warned you about, the, you know, how do you then disqualify a school or a district quickly so that you don't spin your wheels if it's just not meant to be? And so what are the bright spots, the green shoots of districts that get it, of leaders who get it, who are willing to be early adopters?
Yeah, I would say, you know, one of the things that people warn us against or have made sure we spent a lot of time thinking about is that what we're doing doesn't further exacerbate the differences between the schools in areas where students and their families have ample resources and schools in areas that are, you know, extremely resource constrained. And, you know, probably the brightest spot in all of this is that we have been able to raise the most money at the schools where the resources are the fewest. Because what we found is not only are the alumni really, really passionate about their schools in several of these areas, but that the community, the non-alumni community, is really passionate about these schools surviving and thriving and ensuring that the students, that the teachers have a great working environment and can ply their craft, and that the students leave prepared for what comes next, whether it be the workforce or college or military or whatever. So, you know, the brightest spots have been the schools within the Richmond Public School System, RPS. We've had tremendous alumni support, tremendous community support. It's just some great fun deployments. And, you know, our whole philosophy is we don't tell anybody how to spend the money. It's totally up to the principal to determine the best use of the funds that we raise. And all we are is kind of the railroad, the infrastructure to make the, to connect the donors with the schools. And so, you know, sometimes principals come to us and say, hey, I'd like X dollars for this thing that I want to do. And, you know, us working in the organization, not really knowing what's most important at the school level, sometimes we're like, huh, that seems to me like it might not be super impactful. But then you go and you watch it happen, and you go and you take some video of the kids and the teachers, and you realize, you know, there's a good reason why we the people at the foundation and the corporation don't make decisions, because we don't know what's best for these kids. The principals do, the people on the ground do, the teachers do, even the kids know what's best for them and their school. And so it's been great to just be that railroad that connects the donors with the folks who really know what could be most impactful at the school level. And really what's interesting is, you know, these people at the school level, they know more about what's impactful than the school board, the superintendent, and the people that are in management. And all those people, again, have great intentions. They have to think about the whole district. They have to create budgets and allocate resources as best as they can. But then what we do is we inject additional dollars so that ad hoc programs and uses of funding that are just difficult to plan ahead for don't make it into the budget. They get to exist, and things like the arts, or, you know, field trips, or exploring opportunities, or scholarships, or things like that, teacher professional development for teachers, you know, three teachers to go on a trip to some training course that would just never get approved through the budget. All that can now happen, and it has an incredible impact on the teachers and the students within that school. And so it's really inspiring to see that happen.
So playing out with Richmond Public Schools, let's just say, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, I mean, that's part of what you're doing here is you're planting, like you're creating a literal and figurative foundation to build on from here. But help me understand the before and after, if it plays out the way that you hope. Help me understand what that means at a student level. Because I feel like, you know, maybe similar to your investment banking days, part of this is, you know, it's data-driven storytelling. Like, how do we both root this in data and make a quantitative argument, but also talk about the story, the kid, the teacher, the human connection that helps take something like data that might not tug at the heartstrings in the same way, and then paint a picture for, and how do we go do that 100 or 1,000, you know, or 1,000,000 times over the coming years? So how might that play out? And what are some of the before and after stories that you personally have found most inspiring that probably keep you going in the face of the friction and the challenges you've outlined?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, one of the most impactful moments was when we first got started. We started working with a school called Armstrong High School in Richmond. Great school, great principal, cares a ton about the school. They have a plaque above principal's office from back in 2018 when the Washington Redskins at the time gave the school a $5,000 check. So that's kind of their idea of fundraising. There's a plaque. So we had an event, and we spoke to a bunch of local businesses and philanthropists. And we ended up raising $130,000in this one event that we had for the school. And it was really for the school and for other RPS schools who wanted to take advantage of this fund. And so we went to meet with the principal, and we said, well, what's the first thing you want to do? And she said, well, RPS, Richmond Public Schools, a couple of years ago bought 20 smart boards. I think they're like, at the time, like $10,000 a piece. So a couple hundred grand worth of smart boards. And in the budget, they didn't budget installing them or hanging them. So they've been sitting in a closet for like a year or two. And so we said, well, how much would that be? She said, well, we have an invoice from a local contractor who could do it for $350 per smart, so $7,000. So we learned about that on Monday. We contacted the contractor. He came in on Tuesday, installed it Tuesday and Wednesday. By Thursday, we were there with our video, with our iPhones, videoing these teachers, getting to know this technology. The kids thought it was the coolest thing. You know, my kids in private school have had smart boards since kindergarten because the school has the resources. At Armstrong, all of a sudden, these kids are learning in a totally new way. It's like having the power of the internet and a chalkboard all in the same time. And it was dramatic. And, you know, we heard anecdotally that like history scores went up by 20 points and math scores went up by X. And, you know, just for $350 smart board, because the county didn't budget, you know, hanging them. So just kind of nuts. Another one that I thought was super cool was the principal said that she wanted the honors kids to go on a trip to the Black History Museum in DC. And, you know, at the time I was like, yeah, field trips, like, is that really that important? But, you know, again, we don't make opinions. That was an internal thought. So we cut them a check to make it happen. It was for many, the vast majority of these kids, the first time they've been on a train, first time they've been in DC. Now, these are 18-year-olds, 16 to 18-year-olds. We're an hour and a half from DC. So not that far, but these kids had just never been there. They were super inspired by walking through the museum and seeing their history. We've got videos of it. And, you know, I'm not usually like an emotional person, all that emotional, but like I was bawling when I was watching these videos. I mean, it was just so incredible to see. And so just being able to, you know, deploy dollars like that feels really good. Your question was about the big picture, right? Like, where does this go 20 years from now? Well, we already have alumni from like the 50s and 60s saying, let's create an endowed version of this so that we can feel comfortable. We have more resources to give than $1,000 or $3,000. Let's build several hundred thousand dollar pool of capital that will grow to be million and millions. And so that we know that the students and the kids and the teachers will have the ability to do things like this going forward.
Well, and I would think given, yeah. You know, for example, what you just highlighted, there has to be a tremendous planned giving opportunity in some of these communities where maybe there isn't, I don't know, the kind of cash resources or, you know, liquidity that you might find elsewhere, but that there are assets that, you know, if there were a vehicle to structure it, I don't know if that's something that you all are exploring, but it would seem intuitive that there'd be opportunity there.
100%. I mean, we've set the platform up to accept gifts however people want to give them. PayPal, Venmo, Apple Pay, Google Pay, donate your car, credit card, ACH, planned giving, you know, stock transfers, whatever. We even have some scholarships that have been set up outside of our system where they're being transferred into our system so we can administer the scholarships going to the right places. So, you know, we kind of view this like we really use the Boston Latin example as our North Star. And they have just done such an incredible job. And if you talk to them, you'll know that they maybe had one major gift, one, you know, seven-figure gift, not eight, or, you know, not an eight-figure gift. And mostly they get, you know, $1,000 to $2,000 gifts from a nominal number of people, alumni, and that gets invested efficiently and used well. And it has created this $75 million endowment. So it's not like we need to go out and find the $10 million, $50 million gift anywhere. If we can get, you know, a lot of these schools have 30,000 alum. If we can get 1% of them to give $100 a year forever, that's a lot of money. If we can get 2% of them to give 2% a year, that's a tremendous amount of money. You know, think back, like, there's a plaque at Armstrong High School for when they got a $5,000 gift. So the bar is actually really low for new dollars to come in and create incredible impact. So we're really excited about, you know, this database we're building and being able to use it to develop alumni, show them what the possible is. They almost everybody gives to their college, or at least knows what that looks and feels like, or they've done well in life. Their kids go to private school. They know what that looks and feels like. they're just, you know, initially a little unsure of what that means in a public school setting. So that's what we're trying to educate to the 200 million Americans that went to public school on, you know, where they should be focusing their philanthropy. Because the reality is that $100 gift to Yale versus $100 gift to Armstrong High School has dramatically different impacts. And you should be putting your money where the impact is the greatest, and that would be in the public school system.
Yeah. Now, somebody at Yale would argue, no, because that is what allows us to have need-blind financial aid and get the kids from Armstrong High to go to Yale and not pay anything, right? So the argument can go either way, but we are primarily working with an audience here of, let's call it private high school or private or public higher education or nonprofit fundraising professionals. So what is the intersection? You know, is there anything our listeners can do to help? I mean, how do you think about learning from, applying from, but also further innovating, modernizing what has worked well in other settings like Boston Latin or Yale?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think one of the things that I wish the whole community would just do is let this thing simmer, let it cook and see what the outcomes are. We have counties that we haven't even started working in saying, oh, this is going to be competitive with my local ed foundation. Don't come here. Oh, you know, this is going to be confusing to parents who give to the PTA. Don't come here. And, you know, what we would argue is let it cook for a year. See what happens. See if there's one penny that comes from your ed foundation into what we're doing, or one penny that comes from the PTA that goes to us instead of them. I think it'll be zero. And if it isn't, then we'll figure out a way to make 1 + 1 = 2. But to, you know, to block an idea with this much potential before it has the opportunity to germinate is a real shame for your community. And so we've seen it a ton. It's unfortunate. We do our best to, you know, kind of explain what we're doing, but the bureaucracy is a solid machine, and it gets its way. And we've been battling that for the last year.
What if we have fundraisers listening who have their kids in a public school right now who are saying, I know how to raise money, and I know that my kid's school would really benefit from this. How do we get y'all in there? What do they do?
Just go to tepf.org, send me an email at mbor@endowmentproject.com. We'd be happy to plug into your school. We're currently only in Virginia, but there's really no reason that we can only be in Virginia. We can be anywhere. So if you live in Andover, Massachusetts, and your kids go to Andover High School, give us a call. We'll talk to the principal. We'll plug in. We'll start building the database for Andover High School. We'll hold an event. We'll figure out what the principal thinks the greatest needs are for Andover High School, and we'll start doing our work. And we're happy to do this anywhere where people think there's a great opportunity. So we'd love to grow and raise more and more money. We think this can be a multi-billion-dollar-a-year raise for the 25,000 public high schools that exist in the U.S. And then, frankly, you know, this whole concept of being outsourced alumni development and fundraising operation can expand its tentacles into other education or non-education sectors. So we're really just excited to make this thing work, grow it, and be super helpful to organizations that don't necessarily have the scale to have their own sophisticated Andover level, development operation.
I love it, Michael. I'm so grateful that you're working on this. It's obviously a huge challenge, a big idea, tremendous need. And I think one of those where just at a high level, it makes sense. And then obviously at a low level, that's where it gets messy and you're navigating that. But I hope that folks listening will reach out and connect, find you on LinkedIn, shoot you an email as you just shared. And if there are things that we can do as you continue to scale the work to support you, I know that we'll be in touch as well. So just want to say thanks for sharing your story and wish you the absolute best.
Thanks, Brent. Always great chatting with you. Appreciate it.
Thanks. With that, I'm going to close today's episode with Michael Bohr, who's co-founder and CEO at The Endowment Project. Thanks, everybody. Take care.